this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top, Medical Device Supplier Okay with ACA Tax. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Kerry. Sam Kumar is relaxed, sitting in the boardroom of Myco Medical, the medical device supply company he founded in 1993. Given all the focus that has been on the medical device industry lately, his demeanor is surprising. After all, it was essentially the 2.3% tax on medical device manufacturers imposed by the Affordable Care Act that ground the government to a halt earlier this month. A block of members of the House of Representatives, primarily Republicans, who wanted to repeal the entire act, initially refused to pass a federal budget because this tax was included. The tax is expected to raise $30 billion and help pay for the ACA. Of course, the budget did pass at the 11th hour before the United States reached the debt limit, and Kumar has kept a cool head. He sees the 2.3% tax on medical devices as his industry's way of doing its part for overall health care reform. It's how we're going to contribute to the Reform Act, he says from his Kerry office. Of course, he doesn't like paying more taxes, no one does, but he acknowledges there are other aspects in the ACA that will benefit him. For instance, there will now be an additional 30 million people with health insurance. That's essentially 30 million more customers for him and his company. Over time, we should see this increase our revenue, he says. It's an opinion shared by healthcare experts. I totally agree with what he is saying, says Dr. Peter Ubel, healthcare economist and professor of business administration and medicine at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. They got more customers and in return helped pay for the legislation. Sounds like win-win to me. The Medical Device Association, which has a strong lobby in Washington, saw things differently. It says the tax will cost 43,000 jobs. However, Bloomberg government took a look at some of the claims, including that the tax would cut much as $6.7 billion off the industry's annual revenue of $116 billion. Bloomberg found those numbers to be skewed, estimating it would cut into revenue by about $670 million, a sizable figure to be sure, but small when compared to the industry's sales as a whole. Others have pointed out that medical devices are a healthy margin portion of major healthcare companies' revenues. Consider Johnson & Johnson. In just the second quarter of 2013, it recorded $1.5 billion of pre-tax profit from its medical device and diagnostics division. It recorded $7.2 billion in sales, giving it a profit margin of 21%. It estimates the tax will cost it only about $300 million. Instead of using its clout to lobby against the device tax, which helped foment opposition to the Affordable Care Act, the medical device industry needs to share the responsibility of lowering costs for patients, businesses, and taxpayers, wrote Topher Spiro, Vice President for Health Policy at the Center for American Progress, in a New York Times opinion piece. And the rest of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is taken up by the cover story for this edition. The headline, North Carolina Film Incentives, Hit or Flop? Debate continues over economic benefits of state tax incentives. And this article has a dateline of Raleigh. 14 months. That's the time North Carolina has to convince lawmakers that incentives for Hollywood films and TV series are a good thing and a worthwhile economic tool. The state's film incentive, awarded to filmmakers as a 25% tax credit, is set to expire January 1, 2015. In recent months, conflicting reports have surfaced as to how much the filming of movies and TV shows actually boosts North Carolina's economy. Some legislators argue that such incentives result in an erosion of the tax base, with taxpayers essentially cutting the check to film companies that take their box office profits home to California. Others maintain in the industry's presence leads to job growth and increased revenues for local industries that play a supporting role. Since the incentive was first implemented in 2006, there's been a steady increase in the amount of money film production spend in the Tar Heel State, as well as jobs added for each production. The year before the incentive went into place, state documents show that film production spent $1.5 million in the state and created 16 jobs. A year after the incentive, the numbers jumped to $117 million spent in the state by film productions and a whopping 8,833 jobs created. Numbers dropped sharply in 2010, but thanks to the filming of Iron Man 3 and The Hunger Games, about 20,000 jobs were created by the film industry in 2012. Now, many small businesses in film-happy locales like Charlotte and Wilmington, particularly those in the hospitality sector, worry about revenue loss after the sunset of the film incentives. The fears that producers will bolt for surrounding states with similar amenities, where incentives are not only higher, but in some places, guaranteed. Measuring economic impact. The production of Iron Man 3, Caged, brought $83 million to North Carolina, for which the filmmaker received $20 million in tax credits. Filming took place in Wake, Duplin, and New Hanover counties and employed 2,377 people for multiple weeks. The production of Hunger Games, which spanned nine counties and resulted in $55 million in revenue to the state, created 1,133 jobs and generated $13 million in tax credits. These figures come directly from the North Carolina Department of Revenue. But Senator Bob Rucho, a Republican from Charlotte, says the state benefits very little from any kind of tax incentives, claiming that direct jobs gained are too small to justify the loss of tax revenues. Rucho has been an outspoken proponent of tax reform, including the expansion of the sales tax base and the elimination of preferential treatment afforded by certain exemptions, credits, and deductions. Based on the facts that have come in, and not on industry information, it appears that the incentives did not deliver results in long-term jobs, Rucho said. If we're going to invest money, we want long-term jobs. Rucho references a Regional Economic Models Incorporated, REMI, study conducted by the North Carolina General Assembly's Fiscal Research Division, which estimates a mere 55 to 70 jobs were created in 2011 by the film industry. He also says project-based film industry jobs cannot be compared to other project-based jobs such as contracting and construction. Why would you invest in something that is haphazard? No films ever make a profit in this state, so they are not taxed at North Carolina rates. The film credit has a limited effect on North Carolina economy. What ends up happening is that this is refundable. A tax credit is, if we make money, we put it against a profit we make. There's credit. This is, you get a check back. It's not a good way to do this, Rucho said. But North Carolina State University professor Rob Hanfield says the REMI method isn't valid because it doesn't take into account that the film industry is run like a supply chain. He has proposed a new way to look at its economic impact. I never realized how strong the industry is here or how competitive it is, Hanfield said. The other states like Georgia, New York, and Louisiana, there is a strong amount of competition. I didn't realize the incentive is essentially one of the most important factors when deciding where to shoot a film. If they pull it, the whole industry would pull out. It would affect local businesses, restaurants, hotels, and construction. Something has been filmed in every single county in the state, so literally every county is impacted. The incentives have created the industry. The data Hanfield is collecting is being compiled into a study that lobbyist John Merritt of McGuire Woods hopes will show how critical the film industry has become to the state. He believes a new analysis will show that the state's economy depends on the film industry, and in anticipation of the May legislative session, he's got a petition circling to collect signatures of others that feel the same way. North Carolina's competition. Louisiana's Executive Director of Economic Development, Chris Stelly, says his state's goal has been to grow the film industry locally to sustain it, and one way is to make its 30% incentive tax credit permanent. Louisiana has had a consistent and stable tax incentive program that productions have been able to rely upon, Stelly says. We have had our incentive program in effect since 2002 and have worked hard to build up a deep, experienced crew base, state-of-the-art infrastructure, including sound stages and post-production houses. Plus, we have a film-friendly communities and diverse locations. It is a combination of everything that Louisiana has to offer a creative industry. Our long-term strategy has really been to focus on building a self-sustaining indigenous film industry for the future of our state. We're doing just that using our great incentive program. In addition to a 20% state tax credit, Georgia offers an additional incentive if a film includes the Georgia Peach. In Georgia, we offer competitive incentives, a deep crew base, accessibility via the world's busiest airport, a variety of locations, mountains, coast, big cities, small towns, and much more, and infrastructure, says Stephanie Popek, communications manager for the Georgia Department of Economic Development. Since 2010, we have had 11 studios announce they were coming to or expanding in Georgia. We have had more than 70 support service type companies relocate to Georgia as well. We like to say we offer productions the entire package. Wilmington's film foothold. For years, Wilmington has enjoyed return visits from the film industry for ongoing TV shows such as Dawson's Creek and One Tree Hill. The Occult, filmed in New Hanover, Brunswick, and Pender counties, spent $7 million and created 886 jobs, according to the North Carolina Department of Revenue. Stuart Capps, manager of sales at the Hilton Wilmington Riverside, says the film industry helps fill the hotel during the week when business is generally slow for hotels. The film community is a huge part of Wilmington and the surrounding areas, Capps says. They're a huge part and one of the best relationships that I have consistently. If the incentives were to go away, this town and the state as a whole would definitely feel the impact. Proponents of the tax incentives believe that cuts would prematurely chop off a burgeoning industry that employs film crews, set builders, caterers, and other services to accommodate for the extra business that comes in with actors, extras, and crews. And those workers are also buying local food and using local amenities. In addition to food and lodging, productions also need to buy construction materials and services locally. For example, the filming of Fox TV's Sleepy Hollow at New Bern's historic Tryon Palace called for a dirt road to be built in front of the palace to make the story's time context seem more realistic. Jimmy Sessoms, owners of Smooth's Traffic Control LLC, says his business grew out of the need to block roads and redirect traffic during film and TV show shoots in Wilmington. Although Sessoms doesn't rely entirely on filmings, he said he employs 25 people, many of whom he wouldn't need to hire if there were no more films being shot in the area. From the filming alone, I make probably about $100,000 a year, said Sessoms. I would lose that money if the film industry left. The role of certainty. According to North Carolina Film Office Director Aaron Sirrett, TV shows like to plan a few seasons out before investing in a production or seeking a location. Some of the producers of these shows have already crossed North Carolina off their list, he said. The uncertainty about whether the incentive will be renewed is causing productions to look elsewhere. But apparently not for Sleepy Hollow. Parts of the show were shot at Tryon Palace. Proprietors of the Tryon Palace said they saw 200 to 300 visitors per day during filming. It was the first time a major production came to New Bern, and hotels filled to capacity for a short while. According to Tryon Palace representatives, the location was such a big factor for the show that its producers returned for a second season. And along with this article is also a short section titled, By the Numbers, Recent Film Projects in North Carolina. Here's a list of movies filmed in North Carolina along with total spending, cost of credits, and number of people employed. Iron Man 3, total spending $81 million, cost of credits $20 million, people employed 2,377. Hunger Games, total spending $55 million, cost of credits $13.8 million, people employed 1,133. The Odd Life of Timothy Green, total spending $88,193. Cost of credits, $159,909. People employed, 84. The Conjuring, total spending, $16.9 million. Cost of credits, $4.3 million. People employed, 419. Safe Haven, Total spending, $17.1 million. Cost of credits, $4.2 million. People employed, 135. North Carolina is also host to many TV series, including the HBO series Eastbound and Down, and the acclaimed Showtime drama Homeland. Others include The Bachelorette, One Tree Hill, and Salvage Dogs. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. A quick glance at Triangle happenings. Local team snags third at USTA tourney. Seems like those tennis courts at Prestonwood Country Club in Cary are being put to good use. Word has it that the Prestonwood Country Club ladies CTRL 3.5 Spring Adult 40 and Over tennis team, representing the Southern Section, finished third at the United States Tennis Association National Championships in Indian Wells, California, held October 10 through 13. The 14-member team, captained by Karen Coe, whose day job is as a realtor with Go Realty in Cary, was the first to represent Prestonwood in national competition in the club's 25-year history. The PCC team advanced through the tourney by defeating opponents from Nevada, Texas, and New Jersey. The team succumbed to a Northern Oregon team in the semifinals and earned third-place honors by defeating a Tulsa, Oklahoma team in a consolation match. The joke's on you, Steve. At last week's TBJ-hosted CIO Awards, MC Steve Daniels of ABC TV 11 learned how hard it is to be a stand-up comic, even for a TV anchor used to being on camera. His script included reciting a few IT jokes submitted by award winners. Whether it was the jokes or the delivery, it was fortunate there was a laugh track. It also helps if the award recipients have a knack for improv. After reading a joke about a CIO and a CFO being held up at gunpoint, Daniels asked winner Bruce Humphrey, CIO of the North Carolina Community College System, whether he and his CFO had ever been held up, as in the joke. Humphrey didn't miss a beat, quipping, "No, but I've been held up by my CFO." What's in a name? To Medfusion plenty. Steve Malik, the man who in August bought back the company he had sold to Intuit, is reviving the Medfusion brand. What, under Intuit's leadership, was known as Intuit Health, is now officially Medfusion again. The name the health software company had when it was first a private company. "We actually ran a contest where we had all kinds of creative ideas that were put out there," he says, adding that prizes were given to creative names. Among them, one brave employee suggested a play on Malik's name, Malware. "That's one that certainly wasn't going to win," Malik laughs, adding that there was resounding consensus to bring the old name back. A paleo diet of new national customers. Joe Colopy, CEO of Durham-based marketing company Bronto Software, is notorious for passing out inflatable dinosaurs. After Bronto announced some significant client adds for the quarter, including Godiva, Brahmin, Flower Delivery Express, and BH Cosmetics, it's clear that the Bull City's favorite dinosaur isn't going extinct anytime soon. Attorney chosen to ring NASDAQ bell. Local attorney and entrepreneurial activist Mita Patel was tapped to ring the closing bell last week at NASDAQ in New York. "I just hope I don't have spinach in my teeth," he laughs. Patel, no stranger to public speaking, so the chances of a spinach-tainted smile are minimal, is a name you're likely to see in press releases for events such as Triangle Startup Weekend. Patel, who practices with Triangle Business Law, rang for UP Global, an organization that recently partnered with Google and is trying to empower entrepreneurs and innovation-heavy communities like the one in Durham. UP Global got the ringing honor due to an announcement that it will be doubling its impact over the next 3 years. While an honor, it's not something Patel would have written as a life goal in a high school essay. "The only time I would have seen this opportunity come is if a client IPO'd. That's the kind of thing a corporate attorney like me probably has in their dreams." Contributing to Biz were staffers Cameron Snipes and Lauren Onsorge. And now we return to a full-length article in the Triangle Business Journal. The title on this article, Red Hat and others gaze at cloud for future growth. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a Dateline of Raleigh. Lee Congdon, Red Hat's chief information officer, echoes what CEO Jim Whitehurst has said, cloud is coming. But with September delivering a third consecutive quarter of missed deferred revenue for the Raleigh-based open-source firm, there's added pressure to deliver. With the move to Red Hat Tower finally complete, the company has officially dug its heels into Raleigh, and the investment and job promises Red Hat have issued give Raleigh a stake as well. We're not projecting any immediate revenue from cloud service, Congdon cautions. We're just scratching the surface. Ed Anderson, research director at Gartner, agrees it will take years for cloud services to overtake what's being done in companies' own data centers. He sees the cloud promise as a transformation of the relationship between IT and business. For the first time in decades, business again takes the driver's seat. Organizations which embrace this model will be more agile and adaptable to their customers, partners, employees, competitors, and the broad market opportunities and challenges constantly confronting them. And they will operate at new levels of efficiency that can't be matched by traditional models. As Congdon told a supportive crowd at the All Things Open conference in downtown Raleigh on October 23, part of that efficiency will be in on-demand purchases. Instead of making their IT buys with long-term needs in mind, the cloud will increase accessibility to solutions, meaning IT managers can make purchases on an as-needed basis. But the excitement is not being matched by the customers. The real realization of cloud computing is the effect it will have on organizations which adopt a new operating model that aligns with the cloud principles of agile, on-demand processes supporting the changing needs of businesses, says Anderson. And once that promise is realized, there will be winners and losers. I think it comes down to which organizations, both end users and vendors, are adopting the new cloud models, he says, pointing to Amazon as a great example of what it looks like. Their pricing, billing, contracts, services, partner programs, etc., all reflect the new cloud operating model. Other vendors, he adds, promote themselves as cloud providers but still operate in the legacy model. These vendors won't do well over the long term because they won't be agile enough to match the pace of the market and also won't be efficient enough to compete in the new high-scale cloud markets. Mladen Vuk, department head and professor for information technology at North Carolina State University, says we're where we should be in cloud development. What we don't really know is what the demand is going to be and what additional services we would like to build for everybody. Where almost everything exists in the cloud and you're comfortable in that it's safe and it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg to get there. Red Hat's open source approach could provide an edge. Vauk says open source offers flexibility and security that appeals to customers. If you have an open source product, you can actually look into it and make sure it does what it's supposed to do and make it very, very, very secure, he says. Red Hat isn't the Triangle's only stake in that cloud future. Companies in Research Triangle Park such as IBM, EMC, and NetApp have their eyes on the virtual skies, too. And now we turn to our reporter pages. First, we have the page of Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. And his first section is titled From the Web. The first article, Raleigh seniors obtain more meds than most. Seniors in Raleigh fill more prescriptions per year than in the state's other metro areas, and also more than in many of the cities to which Raleigh is often compared. In Raleigh, Medicare Part D beneficiaries filled an average of 50.4 30-day prescriptions in 2012, more than in Charlotte, Durham, Greensboro, and Asheville, according to the Dartmouth Atlas of Medicare Prescription Drug Use. It was also higher than in cities like Austin, Texas, San Jose, California, and Portland, Oregon. Medicare Part D plans are similar to other Medicare plans in that they are funded partly by taxpayer dollars, but differ in that they are administered through private insurance companies such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. The Dartmouth Group has demonstrated wide regional variation in health services utilization that cannot be explained by patient needs or preferences alone in the past. In this report on prescription usage of Medicare Part D beneficiaries, the group's most recent, Dartmouth shows wide variation in prescription drug use as well. Walgreen report barely mentions Carr drug deal. Anyone looking to learn a little more about the acquisition of Carr Drug's retail stores by Walgreen Company was disappointed when Walgreen recently released its annual report. The 42-page report included exactly one mention of Carr. In September 2013, we entered into an agreement to acquire certain assets of Carr Drug. The acquisition includes 76 retail drug stores, as well as a specialty pharmacy business and a distribution center, all based in North Carolina. The transaction is subject to satisfaction of regulatory requirements and other conditions and is expected to close in calendar 2013. That's all Walgreen Company shareholders got to learn about the deal. Medicaid backlog blamed on coding. The state is still having problems paying out Medicaid claims through its new system, and doctors are still the providers who see the brunt of the errors. Called NCTRACS, the new claims payment system run by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, went live in July amid warning signs that there would be early issues. Secretary Aldana Wos responded to concerns before a joint legislative meeting in early October, but few lawmakers were satisfied with her answers. Doctors have complained since the NCTRACS system went live on July 1 that they have had Medicaid billing problems. DHHS officials have largely blamed what's called taxonomy codes, the system of medical codes that NCTRACS uses to determine whether a provider has the proper credentials to bill for the item or procedure on a claim. Institutional claims are those that come from facilities, usually hospitals, while professional claims are those from providers. There are approximately 23,000 physicians practicing in North Carolina, according to the NC Medical Board. Medicaid will pay out roughly $13 billion this year for health care on the state's poorest citizens, mostly to women and children. The federal government covers about two-thirds of those costs. Hospitals now graded on patient engagement scores. Patient engagement is the new name of the game in healthcare delivery, and hospital financial officers are beginning to take note. That's because reimbursements are now tied in part to patient engagement scores, so hospitals could lose out on revenue if they receive bad scores. Patient satisfaction surveys are nothing new, of course, but the federal government only recently introduced a standardized survey in an effort to improve overall quality. The survey is called the Hospital Care Quality Information from the Consumer Perspective, but goes by the acronym HCAHPS, colloquially pronounced HCAPS, and hospitals are taking this survey seriously. Naturally, measures of quality outcomes, mortality rates, and patient safety are still the most important. But after that, patient engagement is right up there, says Alan Wolf, spokesman for Rex Healthcare. Using publicly available data on patient engagement, including some from HCAPS, Axial ranks hospitals on patient engagement. And in the final section on this page, there's the headline. Wolfpack Club looking to raise $14 million for a new sports facility. The Wolfpack Club is raising $14 million for a new 90,000-square-foot indoor training facility for NC State Athletics. The club's executive director, Bobby Purcell, says the club is in the silent phase of that campaign and would not divulge how much has been raised to date, but that the club is currently focused on major donors. In addition to fundraising, NCSU established a site selection committee that is working through the best locations for the facility. Purcell said the facility would be located somewhere on the Carter Finley Stadium complex just off Wade Avenue between Edwards Mill Road and Blue Ridge Road in western Raleigh. And the big number of the week, 318,803, the total attendance in the first weekend, Thursday through Sunday, of the 2013 State Fair, including 105,310 on Sunday. And on the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge, OnSorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. The first section, Focus on Growth. This article has the headline, Nimble Storage Steps Out with $150 Million IPO. Nimble Storage, a Silicon Valley-based IT and hardware firm that planned operations in Raleigh earlier this year, filed for a $150 million initial public offering on October 18. Nimble, which provides flash-optimized hybrid storage solutions, announced in February that it opened a research and development facility where it employs 43 workers. When the company announced the opening, CEO Suresh Vasudevan said the facility could house up to 100 employees focused on engineering, customer support, and sales. But its local employees aren't the only reason the Research Triangle should pay attention. Nimble lists RTP storage behemoths EMC and NetApp among its competitors, and the numbers show Nimble is a growing force. The company reports $50.6 million in revenue for the 6 months ended July 31, 2013, which nearly reaches its 2012 annual total of $53.8 million. The company reported a net loss of $10.6 million for 2012. And the next article on this page has the headline, Idea Sprouting at Bayer Crop Science. Bayer Crop Science was a loud place on October 17 with an entire office wing closed for demolition. But scientists at the site aren't complaining about the trucks coming in and out of the gates because they mean long-awaited change is coming, and job seekers should be celebrating too. Jim Blom, Bayer Crop Science CEO, says the $33 million upgrade to the company's Research Triangle Park site will translate to triple-digit jobs. "We're expanding here, and we have a need for additional workspace," he says, adding that the facility hasn't had major renovations since being constructed in 1980. "We're expecting about 100 new hires over the next 3 years. There are 500 employees currently at the space. The company employs 640 workers in the triangle overall. Blom says the new design isn't just a workspace. It's etching our cutting-edge business with a cutting-edge image," he says. "It's also a firm whose entire business model is focused on the future," he adds, noting that the regulatory process is often 10 to 15 years. "That futuristic theme will be realized in the new design," he says. The RTP campus was the obvious choice for the renovation, as it's ground zero for Bayer's plant business, along with the seed division's recent move to the park. The last research lab bearing the Bayer name moved its employees to the site from Kansas. Even without the renovations, Bayer is a bustling place. "We're enjoying looking out over the campus and seeing the slab being finished on our Bee Care Center," he says, a center that broke ground this summer. "We expect to see it rise from the foundation very, very quickly." With Research Triangle Park becoming a hub for all things plant science, I thought it appropriate to ask Blom about the genetically modified foods debate. As agricultural innovation in the park increases, so does the debate. So I asked Blom for what he thought was the biggest misconception about plant science. "That it's new. We've had genetically modified soybeans and corn in the U.S. for over 16 years, and we've been eating a lot of this innovation over a significant period of time. And over the past year, the publicity has picked up as legislative activity emerges, trying to label foods with GMO ingredients. Blom is okay with the labels. It makes sense. I don't know why it hasn't been there before." And the last section on this page is a section called He Said It. Paul Ulanch, Executive Director of Biotechnology Crop Commercialization at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, says an announcement that Bayer Crop Science is pumping $33 million more into its Research Triangle Park campus isn't just good news for CEO Jim Blom and company. "It's further validation of RTP's solidifying status as ground zero for agrobiotech in the United States. And that's not the only good news RTP will see coming out of the plant science industry." Bayer Crop Science's move, Ulanch says, is to prepare for future expansion. and it's a pattern he sees with Syngenta and BASF, and he's hoping someday to have another big player in the park. Oh, and actually, this reporter's page, Lauren Onsorges, continues into the next page. There's a section, Smart Shoppers, the headline here. SaaS exec, store loyalty cards really do work. Grocery store customer loyalty cards are working. That's according to a presentation on SaaS business analytics research by Pamela Prentice, SaaS chief research officer. Prentice's team spent the summer surveying customers to get an idea of which companies they thought understood them the best. The results are interesting and give us a good idea of what analytics are working and what aren't. But there is a balance. Customers seem to want businesses to have the data to cater their services, but want to feel confident that there is a mechanism for securing that data. 71% of those surveyed are concerned about data privacy, but 60% still want businesses to understand them. And business analytics have helped 38% of those surveyed see less irrelevant mail, according to SaaS. And we also have some numbers concerning SaaS. The headline on this listing, SaaS maintains its massive footprint at Cary Campus. 900,000, the total acreage of the SaaS campus in Cary. 300,000, that's how much of the land that has been developed. 3,000, that's how many pieces of art that call SaaS home. There are two resident artists and designers who select potential pieces for the collection, but the final say is Ann Goodnight's. 1,100, that's how many offices are just in building R, the largest structure on the campus. The building houses research and development offices. And finally, 1,400, the headcount in building R. And in one last section, titled In the Works, the headline is, What's keeping Lenovo from acquiring BlackBerry? Could a Lenovo-BlackBerry deal be in the works? The rumor mill has been running for weeks that the Chinese computer maker, which has its America's headquarters in Mooresville, and the Canadian smartphone maker, which maintains Triangle operations, might strike a deal. John Fenebresque, managing director of Charlotte-based investment banking advisory firm Fenebresque & Company, weighs in on the potential match. Given some of the security and national interest concerns, you could see a situation where they split the assets between hardware and software, allowing Lenovo to manufacture devices without necessarily controlling the software. And the next reporter page is for reporter Dawn Curry. Curry covers money and small business. The headline on her article, RTP Radisson Hotel to be demolished, site razed. The Radisson RTP Hotel at Research Triangle Park in Durham, which has served as a go-to meeting place for local businesses over the past four decades, will soon be torn down. The owner of the hotel, Mercantile Commerce Bank of Boca Raton, Florida, has sold the hotel to the Research Triangle Foundation, which plans to demolish the hotel, according to Bob Golis, the foundation CEO. We don't intend to keep the hotel open, Golis said, adding the hotel was an eyesore. While we haven't set a date for when we will demolish it, we will take the hotel down. If you look at our master plan, this will be one of the first tangible signs that the park is changing. The hotel will be closed on November 17. And on this page, there's also a section called Nuts and Bolts. The city of Raleigh will seek $18 million in federal funds for transportation infrastructure improvements for wider lanes, new bridges, and new connector roads. Raleigh will apply for the funds through Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization's locally administered projects program. Nine projects are lined up for the funds, with work estimated at about $27 million. The city will need to match the funds. $7.8 million for the Capitol Boulevard, P Street Bridge replacement, and street improvements after the acquisition of the right-of-way, scheduled for 2016. $4.2 million for the Capitol Boulevard Wade Avenue Bridge replacement right-of-way acquisition, scheduled for 2016. $1.7 million for the widening of Crabtree Valley Avenue, The design will include a new interchange connected to the I-440 Beltline. $3 million for West Street extension from Martin Street to Cabrera Street. The design will include engineering of a grade separation under the railroad corridor adjacent to the city's Union Station project. $5.5 million for the new Bern Avenue corridor improvements that will include installation of sidewalks, street trees, transit, shelter improvements, lighting, signage, and storm drain enhancements. $1 million for the Avent Ferry Road bridge replacement, with the grant funding the inclusion of a pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure as part of the replacement of the bridge over Lake Johnson Road, scheduled for 2016. $1.6 million for Capitol Boulevard improvements, which would create sidewalks on both sides of Capitol Boulevard from Spring Forest Road to Old Wake Forest Road. $1 million for bicycle lanes, sidewalks, and landscaping on Blue Ridge Road and Wade Avenue. And $1 million for a proposed pedestrian tunnel under the Western Boulevard at Avent Ferry Road. And finally, we have a section titled Connecting with Superchargers. Over the past 2 months, Tesla Model S sales doubled in the Triangle. After Tesla announced it would unveil a newly constructed supercharger station in Burlington, we learned it would soon build another on I-95 towards Rocky Mount. Despite their popularity, these cars won't be charging in Raleigh or Durham anytime soon. Tesla is purposely building the supercharger stations between cities to connect them. By the end of 2013, the company expects to have 50 across the country, especially along the East Coast. The supercharger delivers 120 kilowatts that replenish half the charge in 20 minutes. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page. We'll read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, who is the editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "With closure comes personal pains." This may not be the news that will shake the economic foundation of the community, but it certainly made me feel sad when I read that the 200-room Radisson RTP Hotel, known for years as the Governor's Inn, is closing its doors next month. And it is being demolished. We learned that the Research Triangle Foundation is the buyer of the property, and as park officials noted, the 41-year-old hotel does not play a role in RTP's future plans. From a vision perspective, it all makes sense. The Radisson RTP is far from portraying the uber transformation of the park. But with decisions like these come personal hardships, and in this case, it comes in the form of 67 workers and the hotel's general manager, Ron Hunter, who has been with the hotel since it opened in 1972. The past can exist in the present, the future can exist in the present, but the present often cannot exist in the present, says the 63-year-old Hunter, referring to change. I haven't looked for a job in 41 years. Hunter started at the hotel as a waiter and slowly moved up the ranks, eventually becoming its general manager in 1995. Not only has he experienced changes in the economics of the lodging industry, it came with a dose of discrimination as well, but it never slowed him down in mentoring and strengthening the work ethic and moral values of his workers. The hotel thrived for the better part of 20 years. But in the past decade, as Hunter acknowledges, the economics of the lodging industry started changing, with several new hotels in the area, a convention center, and a behavioral shift in corporate travel. Coupled with losing the hotel's biggest customer for a period of 4 years recently, Radisson RTP was never going to be what it was before. Tough to absorb a $1 million annual hit, Hunter says, referring to a RTP customer's annual hotel bill. My heart really goes out to them, says Jamie Nunnally, who has booked the hotel for events and conferences for years. They have such a top-notch group out there. So much history surrounds that building, too. President Ronald Reagan was there in the 1980s, and so was Presidents Lyndon Johnson's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, after he lost the presidential election to Richard Nixon in 1968. Hunter fondly remembers the governors that walked the hallways of the hotel during much of the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. But in the same breath, he acknowledges that things are not the same. The hotel will close on November 17, and from what Hunter told me, he is not done working. I am mentally and financially not ready to retire, he says. Hunter will move on with a lot of memories, and so will a lot of people who have done business in the Triangle in the past few decades. I just hope Hunter and his workers have a soft landing. They deserve it. And now we turn to the small business section in the Triangle Business Journal, with the focus being on Charles N. Colvard. The headline, Jewelry Business Goes Global with Its Manufactured Gems. And this article is by Don Curry with the Dateline of Morrisville. When Randy McCullough, president and CEO of Morrisville-based Charles & Colvard, manufacturers of Moissanite jewelry, was selecting his next CFO, he spent many lunches at the Chop House, eating crab cakes with spinach salad, light on the spinach, and sipping tea. Kyle Macemore ended up making the cut because he was more than a numbers guy, and the two have become a focused team, intent on strategic growth and debt-free profit. Charles & Colvard gets manufactured Moissanite, a silicon carbide chunk from Durham-based Cree, and cuts it down into jewels that compete with diamonds for brilliance, luster, and clarity. Moissanite gems are said to refract more light, causing them to shine more brilliantly than diamonds, and at a tenth of the cost. They are so hard to tell apart that on the wholesale loose gem market, it's not unheard of for a bag of diamonds to be fraudulently salted with moissanite. The company brings in $22.4 million in annual revenue, and McCullough says their international business, currently 25% of company revenue, is growing. The company has distributors in India, Hong Kong, Italy, Australia, and other global markets. Among them are two businessmen in India who set up jewelry stores under the name Fiona, affectionately dubbed the Fiona Boys. When we had dinner with the distributors, we asked the Fiona Boys, "Why in God's name did you name it Fiona?" McCullough said. The Fiona Boys say they chose the name based on the popularity of the Disney movie Shrek and its main female character. Although Charles & Colvard's contract with Cree expires in August 2015, the company is unlikely to abandon the relationship. Historically, when the Hunt brothers started Cree, they started Charles & Colvard at the same time. Specifically, they funded each other's operations, said McCullough, who said they keep amending the original contract with Cree. We spent a lot of time with Chuck Swoboda of Cree to strengthen the relationship and to address the fact that agreements and patents run out in August 2015. I'd like to have an agreement in place before then, but we don't want to keep doing amendments. We're working on a new agreement, and our plan is to keep the agreement with Cree. They are close by, know what we need, and are extremely receptive. McCullough says since 2009, he has eliminated negative cash flow by recognizing that working through distributors alone wasn't enough. We set up our own channel of wholesale distribution, especially with mounted jewelry and with the home party business, Lulu's Avenue. We keep growing our business models, said McCullough. We're invested in different business strategies, growing 30 to 40% annually. We see opportunity in front of us. When the gem adventure began, the gems had a hint of green. This set them apart from diamonds almost entirely. The company's new line of whiter gems called Forever Brilliant makes it hard to tell the moissanite apart from diamonds. When I went to them with the newer, whiter material, Cree responded quickly and delivered in 2 weeks, said McCullough. I was surprised. I thought it would take them months. Charles & Colvard used a manufacturer out of Sweden for a short while, but bad investments made the whole thing go sour, and McCullough pulled the plug. The material was not good. It was not a good investment, McCullough said. So far, Cree has been the most reliable and efficient to work with, and it doesn't go unnoticed. We do a special appreciation sale for them the first 2 weeks in December, where we take our team and several thousand pieces of jewelry and sell it to them at cost, he said. We treat them as if they were our employees. The only thing I refuse to do with Chuck is get out there and play basketball with him. Kyle could handle him. And now we turn to the People Spotlight in the Triangle Business Journal, and this spotlight is on Mark Sodacek. Senior Vice President and COO of Fidelity Bank. After nearly a decade in the financial industry, Mark Sodacek has turned the page on another chapter in his career by being tapped as the Chief Operating Officer at Fidelity Bank. In his role as Senior Vice President and COO of Fidelity Bank, Sodacek will be responsible for the loan operations, deposit operations, information technology, and cash management areas of the bank. He also will oversee the bank's day-to-day operations and work to ensure the alignment of company-wide procedures and goals. Fidelity Bank President and CEO Mary Willis is bullish on the hire. "We are excited to have Mark join our management team," Willis says. "Mark's leadership and his knowledge of the financial industry provides the skill set we are looking for to move our company forward. It will help us remain focused on building relationships with our customers and meeting all their financial needs." Fuqua Varina-based Fidelity Bank bills itself as a full-service financial institution with assets of about $1.6 billion. The bank owns and operates 65 branches throughout North Carolina and Virginia. The bank's deposits total about $1.3 billion. Background: Sodacek has more than 9 years of experience in the financial industry, and in addition to his financial background, he is quite active in community efforts. Sodacek is currently a member of and serves as treasurer for the Triangle Land Conservancy. He also serves as an accounting department advisory board member for North Carolina State University, is a member of the North Carolina Association of Certified Public Accountants, and volunteers for Junior Achievement. Education: Bachelor of Science degree in accounting and a Master's of Accounting from Florida State University, CPA designation. Personal: Sodacek and his wife Lisa live in Raleigh. And now we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Massive Wendell Falls project gets new life with new developer. After spending years in real estate purgatory, the 1,400-acre, 4,000-home Wendell Falls project in eastern Wake County is moving forward with a new developer. Wendell's Board of Commissioners recently approved the transfer of the developer's agreement to San Diego-based Newland Communities, which paid an undisclosed sum for the site. The sale closed on October 21. The board's green light gives new life to the project, which is expected to more than double the town's current population of 6,000 and perhaps bring an additional $1 billion in taxable property to the town, according to Wendell Town Manager Teresa Piner. Duke spin-out Aerie prices pre-IPO shares at $12 to $14, and Aerie is spelled A-E-R-I-E. Duke University spin-out Aerie Pharmaceuticals took another step toward becoming a public company when it announced it would initially sell its shares for between $12 and $14. In September, the company announced it would go public and this week filed more paperwork toward that end. Aerie, which will have the ticker symbol A-E-R-I, will be traded on NASDAQ, registered 6 million shares, giving it a proposed maximum aggregate offering price of $85 million. While Aerie is based in Bedminster, New Jersey, the company has a research and development facility in Research Triangle Park. Aerie has 22 employees and is focused on eye diseases, particularly glaucoma. It has already raised more than $70 million in venture capital and has said it wants to grow to 300 employees. 69 companies interested in NC State's $14 million indoor training facility. NC State University's plans to build a $14 million indoor athletic training facility is garnering quite a bit of interest from the construction community. A pre-submittal meeting was attended by 48 design firms and 21 construction contracting firms who, at least through their attendance, showed some interest in the project. The university is requesting qualification packages from design build teams made up of designers and general contractors, meaning any number of those companies present could team together to design and ultimately build the project. These qualification packages are due by Friday, October 27. Raleigh named one of five best places to retire. Raleigh is among the five best places to retire, according to Money Magazine. The magazine unveiled its 2014 list of best places to retire and put Raleigh right up there. It doesn't rank the top five. Donna Rosado, the magazine's senior editor, told the CBS This Morning co-host that Raleigh has long been a very popular destination for retirees. There's been a 97% increase in the population of people 55 to 64, she said. Mild weather, four seasons, and an interesting phenomenon. Many people in the Northeast move to Florida, and then they move to a second retirement in North Carolina. They're called halfbacks. Tesla will unveil under $40,000 car within 3 years. A wallet-friendly Tesla car isn't that far off. Tesla staffer Patrick Jones said a Tesla car that costs under $40,000 will hit the market within the next 3 years. Unfortunately, the concept car hasn't even been created yet. According to Jones, Tesla has all eyes on its newest baby, the Model X, an electric SUV with Falcon doors that has four-wheel drive. Price for the Model X is yet to be announced. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.